Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour has written a wonderful book about the Beatles, Dreaming the Beatles, the love story of one band and the whole world. Rob Sheffield is our guest. Rob is a columnist for Rolling Stone. He writes about music, TV, and pop culture, is the author of many other books, and we'll talk about how these four unlikely lads from Liverpool became the most popular and perhaps the greatest band ever. But before we talk about the Beatles, we have to listen. And this song, an unlikely start, but as far as our guest is concerned, he says, this will really make you want to hear it. If John Lennon never did anything in his life besides write this song, he'd still be one of the coolest humans who ever existed.
Half of what I say is meaningless, but I say it just to reach you, Julia. Julia, Julia, ocean child calls me. So I sing the song of love, Julia.
I'm so glad you wrote this book so we can do a show on the Beatles. Thanks so much for doing it, Rob.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So what is it about that song? That's a big thing you've said. If he never wrote anything else in his life and he wrote a lot beside that song, he would still be a really cool human being. It's a beautiful song.
Unbelievable, and really a one-of-a-kind songs that the Beatles seem to almost specialize in. Things that they did once that other people could have built an entire career imitating.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about their early life, which you outline in the book. It is, what an amazing thing. These four kids, one of whom, Ringo, was incredibly sick and nobody thought he would live very long. They had these really troubled kind of upbringings, and here they are, and they become the most famous band in the whole world. Tell me about how they connected. Let's start with the story of John and Paul. How did they meet each other?
They met in 1957 when they were a couple of teenage guitarists, and they were in love with Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly, and most of all Elvis. And one day in Liverpool, Paul went to a local fair and he saw John up on the stage with his teenage band. And John was singing the song Come Go With Me, the doo-wop song we all know by the Del Vikings. And typically, John couldn't remember the words right, so he was changing them. So it became Come Go With Me Down to the Penitentiary. And they just bonded, and Paul wanted to show off for him because he was about a year and a half younger than John. So he played his guitar, and he played an Eddie Cochran song, and John was impressed that he could play the whole Eddie Cochran song. And John said, well, come join me band.
And they didn't start out playing the instruments that we know them for. What was John playing? What was Paul playing?
Well, they were playing these cheap Liverpool guitars, very much in the skiffle rockabilly mode. It's really strange to think that, you know, these two people who just, you know, happened to meet as teenage boys in Liverpool, of all places, from really hard scrabble working class backgrounds, just discovered each other and brought something out in each other. They discovered that they both loved to write songs, and they became the greatest songwriters ever. There's no story quite like that.
Mm-hmm. And Ringo, I had no idea he was that sick as a child. He spent years in the hospital.
Yes, he spent years at a time in the children's ward of the hospital. They didn't think he'd live to see his 16th birthday. And one day a music teacher came to visit the children's ward and brought musical instruments in. And that was the first time Ringo ever banged a drum. And after that, that's all he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And was George always the quiet one? We think of him that way. You describe him that way. Was he that way in the group?
It's funny because he was really the wildest one. He was the one that was most like an actual juvenile delinquent that the others really kind of pretended to be. He was the one, John's Aunt Mimi, who raised him in Liverpool, she She did not like Paul McCartney and did not approve of him, and she made him use the back door. But she wouldn't let George in the house. And one day she said, John could, okay, bring his friend George over. And George showed up wearing just tight pants and a crew cut. And Mimi took a look at him and said, well, I won't let this child in my house. Ooh. And it's really strange when you think, this is the woman who raised John Lennon, but George Harrison was just too much for her.
Let's play a little bit. This is how we think of them. I'll ask if this song, which we're about to hear, was one of the early songs that they played in the United States. We'll get the background on this, but it obviously was one of their very early ones. So tell me what you think of it, and we'll also hear how their music changed, and they changed dramatically over the course of their time together. Early, early 19 Beatles coming up now. The music credit, from what I've read, is both Paul McCartney and John Lennon. Did they co-write that song?
Yes, they wrote it at a piano that was Paul's father's piano that was at the house at Liverpool, and they were sitting at the piano together, and they were messing around with the piano, and they came upon that big chord, the I Want to Hold Your Hand, that giant leap of a chord, and they just looked at each other and laughed, and they said, that's the one.
And was that one of the songs they played on the Ed Sullivan Show?
Yes, that was one of the first things that America ever heard by the Beatles. They appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show in February 1964, and they played that song, and it's amazing how urgent and emotional it still sounds. There's nothing...
It does, you're right.
Nothing dated or quaint about it, nothing nostalgic about it. It sounds so emotionally direct.
Mm-hmm. You have some very interesting thoughts on their relationship with girls. They really liked girls. Some of them really liked the girls who surrounded them when they were giving performances. They had kind of a tender feelings for girls in a way that maybe many other bands don't have. And even in that song, you can hear some of that, can't you? I Want to Hold Your Hand. What a sweet thing.
Absolutely. It's Paul had this wonderful comment that you know, when the Beatles were starting out, they were about 19, and the girls who were coming to see them were about 17. And he said, so we made sure that the girls who were coming to see knew that the songs were about them, and that's why we always took care to put the words you and she and her into the songs, so they would know that these songs were directly about them. And that's why the Beatles always paid careful attention to pronouns. And a song like Thank You Girl was a song that they wrote explicitly as a thank you to the girls who came to see them.
Mm. Well, you not only say like them, you also say through it all, screaming girls in the audience, whatever, they worshipped girls in the songs. They worshipped girls. Why?
Absolutely. There's something... It's very interesting that the sort of bond that John and Paul had as a couple of lads in Liverpool who nonetheless had been through a lot of heartbreak by the time that they met. When they met in their teens, they were both boys who'd lost their mothers, and that was something that neither of them liked to talk about, but it was something they found out they had in common. And it must have had something to do with how emotional they got in their songwriting and how they could express emotions in their songwriting that other rock and roll songwriters at the time found really hard to access.
Mm. Here are a couple songs that are reminiscences of their childhoods. Let's hear these. Let me find it first on my music list here. Hold on a second. And let me also tell people you're welcome to join our conversation whenever you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our guest, we're happy to have the author of Dreaming the Beatles, The Love Story of One Band and the Whole World. Rob Sheffield is our guest. This is John's Reminiscence. You know which song this is going to be, I'm sure. And it's Strawberry Fields Forever. Give us the backstory to this song before we hear some of it, if you would please, Rob.
Well, Strawberry Field was a place in Liverpool that was near where John grew up. It was an orphanage, actually, and it had a big garden around it. And what John liked to do was climb over the wall and hide in the garden. It was full of overgrown grass and trees, and it was a place where he could just hide out from the world. And it's a song that he wrote when he was in his late 20s and feeling a little bit lost, and a song about wishing to go back to that childhood retreat where you can just hide out from the world.
Mm. And what do you think of this song? Do you love it?
Yes, it's so moving to me, and it's so amazing that it's a song that he wrote during a period where he was far away geographically from the other Beatles for the first time. In 1966, the Beatles took a few months off, and John went to Spain to make a movie called How I Won the War. And that was the movie where he first cut his hair and started wearing glasses. And none of the other Beatles came to visit him except Ringo. And for John, who was someone who had been around the other three constantly since his teens, it was a very isolating experience to be on a movie set far away from the other three Beatles. And he sat on the beach at Almeria in Spain and wrote this song on acoustic guitar. And all these really raw emotions came out of him. That was very rare for him at that point. Mm.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding.
Strawberry Fields Forever. We don't have the song on our list of songs, but tell us the story, because McCartney did a similar thing when he reminisced with Penny Lane.
Yes, it's funny. It's a funny example of how far these two songwriters could go when they were competing, in this case, a friendly way. But John came back, the Beatles came back from their hiatus, and that was the first song John played for the others. This is the song I wrote in the past couple months. And he played it for them, and everybody was just absolutely astounded by this song. And Paul loved that John had written this song about this place that they both remembered from Liverpool when they were boys. So Paul went away, and a couple days later, he'd written Penny Lane about another place in Liverpool that they remembered when they were boys. It's funny that these are songs that they didn't write together as collaborators, but it was songs that came out of that partnership because they were really trying to top each other.
Mm. And when we played Strawberry Fields Forever, was this, when you talk about his going to make the movie, was that when he got back to the UK and went to a gallery and met Yoko Ono? Was that the time period?
Yes, it's funny. He actually went to the gallery and met Yoko Ono 2 days after he got back to England. So he was definitely in a volatile and vulnerable position.
And what was the dynamic among all four of them? Did they really love each other? Did they find each other's company just the best in the world? Nobody else could be as good?
In this period, they did. It's funny how for years and years, the Beatles, they were inseparable, the four of them, from the early days in Liverpool when they were famous in Liverpool, but not outside that. It was always the four of them. They were kind of inseparable. And as they got famous and traveled around the world, they remained that way for years. And it, of course, as everybody knows, in the last 3 years, I guess the last 2 years, it became very difficult for them to even stand to be in the same room together. They had just been together too long. But there was a period right up to 66 and 67 when the four Beatles, they wanted to spend all their time together, all their free time together, even when they weren't working.
Why?
They were on some kind of wavelength. Other people around them could sense, but it was only the four of them. John had this really funny comment. He said, you know, we have met some other people since we became famous, but we've never been able to stand them for more than 2 days. And it's funny that they could have hung out with any, you know, everybody around the world just wanted a piece of the Beatles. They could have hung out with movie stars or royalty or celebrities or anything. But the four of them, they only wanted to be together. So usually if they had a day off, John would walk over to Ringo's house and just sit in the garden.
They did become friends with, who was friends with Dylan? Were they all friends with Dylan or just John?
they all became friends with Dylan. They all kind of competed, I think, to see who could be the closest friends with Dylan. And it turned out to be George was the one who stayed lifelong friends with Dylan. But John and Paul also had very competitive but very friendly relationships with Dylan in the 60s. They really hero worshipped him. And of course, Dylan was somebody who was so remote and intimidating that he was one person who could even make the Beatles nervous.
Mm. And they always kept an eye out for the Stones. A little competitive with the Stones, perhaps?
Yeah, they were the only band. Really, the Stones were the only band that the Beatles felt were rivals and that they worried about. And it used to make John Lennon very upset how every time the Beatles did something, a couple months later, the Rolling Stones would come along and do the same thing. So, you know, the Beatles put out the record Norwegian Wood, where George is playing the sitar, which had never been heard on a pop record before. And a few months later, the Rolling Stones come out with Paint It Black, where Brian Jones is playing a sitar. He first heard of the sitar for the first time when he was over at George Harrison's house. He picked up George Harrison's sitar to play it, and that wound up like being the sound of Paint It Black.
Ooh. Let's hear a little bit of Norwegian Wood, and then we're going to take some phone calls. We're talking about the Beatles this hour of the program with the author of Dreaming the Beatles, The Love Story of One Band and the Whole World. Rob Sheffield, who's a columnist for The Rolling Stone, is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we'll be with you in a moment after we hear a little bit of Norwegian Wood. I've always loved this song, and your writing about it is kind of funny. You talk about the London hipster who's described in Norwegian Wood, who stays up late drinking wine on her rug with John and tells him she has to leave early for work in the morning. She gets John Lennon in her bathtub, and then you say, for that you think she could call in sick. Which is funny.
I love that song, and, you know, it is one of the... One of the things that always amazes me about going back and listening to those records is it's 1965 and the Beatles are writing about these girls with jobs. You know, this girl just casually tells John Lennon, you know, she has to be up in the morning for work. And this is, it's, you know, Bob Dylan never would have done that. The Rolling Stones never would have done that. It was something that the Beatles got to first.
Yeah, I love that song. I'll have to listen to it in its entirety when the show is over. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in. Glenn in Blue Mounds. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi, Bob. Listen.
Hi, Glenn.
This is going to be a chuckler. I'm 66, and my mother's twin brother and his family, my Uncle Lou, and we were all watching Ed Sullivan and the Beatles on, and that day they were visiting us. And my uncle says, after the first couple of songs they sang, says, yeah, they'll never make it.
That's great.
I can still hear him say that.
But a lot of people, when did people realize that this band was truly great?
It's funny that in England, people, you know, the Beatles, they never thought anybody would accept them outside Liverpool. They had Liverpool accents. You know, any other English pop stars, they got rid of their local provincial accents so they could sound like they fit in London. And the Beatles, they never even thought London would make it. And once London accepted them, then they thought, well, you know, okay, England accepts us, but they couldn't have dreamed that America would have completely flipped for them the way America did.
Mm. Glenn, thanks so much for the memory. Let's go to Ed in West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Well, three things. I think we have to talk a little bit about the other drummer, Pete Best.
All right.
The time that the Beatles spent in Germany in the early 60s, and if any of those clubs still exist. And then the thing I really want to know, because I think it was probably the most tellest position a person could have been in, I want to know who the act was immediately followed the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan program, their first appearance.
Yeah, I don't know who that was. You're right about their appearances in Hamburg, I believe it was. These kids were wild.
Unbelievable. And the Beatles are just teenagers. They've never been outside of their hometown. And they go to Germany to play in Hamburg, the sleaze and decadence capital of Europe. And they're playing in the red light district, playing at strip clubs, playing these 18-hour marathon gigs in front of gangsters and cutthroats. And the gangsters sit in the front row cleaning their guns.
Oh, my gosh.
The Beatles said that if there was a fight, if somebody stabbed somebody on the dance floor, they just kept right on playing. So they had to learn under fire. And so they learned just to keep the crowd moving at all costs. And that's really where they learned their chops as a live band. Mm. They kind of had to.
I guess they did. And do you know what act followed the Beatles?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. If you watch the Ed Sullivan show, the Beatles play and they're absolutely astounding. And then a magician comes out to do a card trick and there's complete silence. And it's just agonizing to watch. And you just think,
poor person.
It's absolutely painful. When he woke up that morning, he probably thought, yes, I'm going to be the magician on the Ed Sullivan show. This is the best moment of my career. And instead, he has to go on and do a card trick after the Beatles. I agonize. It's agony to watch.
Oh, I imagine. Thanks, Ed, for the call. Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think if you're of a certain age, you remember a couple of dates, November 22nd, 1963, and then February 9th, 1964, and they were really just a little over 2 months apart. But, of course, the first one was the assassination of President Kennedy. And then a little over 2 months later, when we really needed something to lift our spirits, here come the Beatles, their first appearance on Ed Sullivan. And I was 12 years old at the time, and it's forever kind of burned into my memory. I also wanted to mention we had the opportunity a couple months ago to see Rain, which is the Broadway production of Beatles songs.
Oh.
And I would highly recommend it if you're a Beatles file. We were just far enough back so you couldn't tell it wasn't John, Paul, George, and Ringo. The music is extraordinary. It's done to perfection. They do the entire Sergeant Pepper album.
Oh, wonderful.
And that the Beatles, of course, never performed that live. That was a studio album that they never felt they could perform live, and it was after they had stopped touring. But Rain is an absolutely extraordinary tribute to the Beatles.
Have you seen it? It sounds wonderful. Rob, have you seen it?
No, I haven't. It does sound wonderful. I have to say, you lucky dog. I'm so jealous of you and Glenn who called. Getting to see the Ed Sullivan show as it happened, that's amazing. I'm always jealous of people who got to see that in 1964 as it happened. That was before my time. But it's that excitement is just amazing. I love seeing there are a lot of Beatles cover bands and a lot of Beatles tributes these days. It's funny that the first time I ever saw a band play live, when I was a little kid in the 70s, there was a touring theater production called Beatlemania. And it started on Broadway. I saw it in Boston. And it's funny because it was the first time I'd been in a grown-up theater, and it was also the first time I saw a band play. And it was absolutely amazing to me that they had, you know, the fake John and the fake Paul and the fake George and the fake Ringo, but playing these songs. And just the excitement was absolutely unbelievable for me. I was 11, and it's funny how vividly I still remember that moment.
Steve mentioned Sergeant Pepper's. Which is the best, which is the most accomplished musical, wonderful album? And I guess it would be the best album of all time, because you really think the Beatles are the best of all time. The best album. Was it Sgt. Pepper's?
Sgt. Pepper's is up there. For me, personally, Rubber Soul is, you know, that has my favorite songs.
Like
Norwegian Wood. I mean, what a song. That song alone. There's so much going on. And I love, for something about Rubber Soul, it has their best vocals. They sound so soulful when they sing those songs. It's funny that they had to make that album in such a frenzy because they were under deadline pressure to get something out for Christmas 1965. So they had to make the whole album in a few weeks. They wrote 7 of the songs 1 week before the deadline. But that just loosened them up. They were willing to try anything. And for some reason, I just love Rubber Soul is the one that really, really does it for me emotionally. But Sgt. Pepper is up there, and Abbey Road is up there, and Revolver is up there, and the White Album. really, they never made a bad album or even a lackluster album.
It sounds like they're all up there for you, Rob.
They're all up there, and but it's funny. Everybody has their favorite. For me, Rubber Soul that's the one that really sums it up for me.
Yeah, we welcome more phone calls. We're speaking with Rob Sheffield this hour, and we're listening to the Beatles as well. He's author of Dreaming the Beatles, The Love Story of One Band and the Whole World. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well. You can reach us all of those ways. And did I give you the Twitter thing? It's @KDunnShow. We'll take more phone calls, talk more, listen to more music, have a good time in a moment on the Ideas Network. Ride. We're talking about the Beatles this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number. We go to Jim in Stevens Point. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen and Rob. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is really more of an informational call. I had the good fortune of being a community radio host here in Stevens Point at our community radio station. And every spring, they do 56 straight hours of the Beatles.
Ah.
And the Beatles Fest 2017 is actually coming up May 6th through the 8th. It starts at 6 p.m., and it's all of the Beatles, all of their solo stuff, all of their band, and it just goes on. So if your listeners are interested, they can go to 90fm.org, and they can stream the Beatles to their heart's content that whole weekend.
Oh, how nice of you to call and let us know, and I'm sure people will do just that.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk about the introduction of LSD, the use of drugs. Somebody slipped LSD into their coffee. Is that how they were introduced to it, Rob?
Yes, their dentist. Incredibly strange story.
Yes.
They were having dinner with their dentist. And it was a very strange experience because they had never heard of this drug and they didn't understand what was happening. And afterwards, they tried it again, and it became very influential on their songwriting, more for John, and eventually all four of the Beatles tried it.
Mm. And could you hear the influence of drugs? Did the music change dramatically? The lyrics, did they change?
Yeah, the lyrics changed very dramatically. So, you know, in 1965, they're singing about girls, you know, and Ticket to Ride, that great song that we just heard a piece of. I love that song. Yes. And then a couple years later in I Am the Walrus, they're singing about penguins climbing the Eiffel Tower. And things have gotten a little more surreal. And drugs certainly had something to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they lost people very close to them due to drug overdoses, right?
Yes. The saddest, one of the saddest stories of 60s rock being Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, mm-hmm. who had done so much to shepherd them through success, had been such a loyal and staunch ally for them through all the madness, and had really done a lot to keep them together because he was a very calming influence who genuinely loved them all, and he made it really easy for them to get along with each other, and he was very unstable and died of a drug overdose on Labor Day weekend of 1967, and really the Beatles were never the same band after that, just because he'd really mediated between them, and it was after that that they really started to have trouble getting along.
Hmm. And the trip to India, how did they become, was it George who was interested in a spiritual journey? Did they all embrace it as fully as George did, at least for a period of time?
Yeah, George really led the way for all of them. It's such a beautiful George story. It was music that led the way. They were on the set of the movie Help, which is just a silly comedy, a kid's movie. I love it. I loved it when I was a kid, and I love it now. But it's funny that there's a scene where they're in an Indian restaurant, and there are some Indian musicians playing Beatles songs on sitar. And George walked over and said, "What is this instrument? This is very interesting." And he bought one for himself, got very interested in Indian music and Indian culture and Indian religion, went to India, and it set him off on a lifetime spiritual journey. And I love that it began with that, you know, random little encounter with a sitar in the movie. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, please.
And when the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi came to London to give a lecture, and George's wife, Patty, who was a fan of the Maharishi, suggested that George come along, and George invited all the Beatles, of course, because they were so close and so bonded at this point. All four Beatles went, and they liked the lecture so much that they decided on totally the spur of the moment that all four of them were going to go away to Wales the next morning on retreat with the Maharishi. And so the next morning, all four of the Beatles just hopped on the train, totally spur of the moment, and went in and studied with the Maharishi.
You write about the timelessness of their music. That I didn't realize this, that the Beatles 1 was their best-selling album in 2000, and I believe 2001. So all these generations have embraced them. And we got a comment from Jill on Facebook who says, "Our son requested a Beatles birthday party this year. He's turning Fab 4 years old."
Oh, my gosh. I love that. What a great story. I love that. It's really funny to see the effect that the Beatles have on little kids. I see it with my nieces and nephews. You know, my sisters have kids who are toddlers and tweens. And it's really funny when they hear the Beatles, and they don't know anything about the history, and they don't have any baggage about the backstory. They don't know what they're supposed to like or not. But they hear the Beatles, and it just flips them out. It's funny that hearing 8 days a week or Here Comes the Sun for the first time is just huge for them as little kids. My niece, who's six, she likes to say, "I want to sing the boat," which means Yellow Submarine. It's funny that the Beatles are just an immediate, instant, and universal impact on kids. It's really funny.
Yeah. Well, I think Jill should invite you to her son's birthday party. I think she would have as much fun as anybody.
I love that. A Beatle birthday party turning Fab 4.
I know. That's a good one. Jim in Stevens Point. Hi. I got Jim already. So we go next to Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Tom.
What I wanted to comment on was your guest's comment about Rubber Soul. My sister bought me that album at Christmas in 65. 6 months later, or not 6 months, 1 month later, I was in the Navy and then overseas. Mm. And then came back, and one of the first songs I heard, and this was in the summer of 67, was All You Need Is Love. And that album is imprinted in my brain. And then All You Need Is Love is also there. But one of the other albums, I think, and you almost were just touching on it regarding the movie, is Help. And that's got some really creative songs in it, too. But love your program, and this is really great.
Thanks. Thanks so much. Rob, you want to respond?
Thank you. Oh, my gosh. All You Need Is Love. What a phenomenal song. And it's really funny that that's another one that they did on a deadline. An example of how the Beatles could just move so fast. They had this worldwide TV special that Brian Epstein signed them up to do. And John said, "Oh, well, I guess we better write a song for it." And overnight, practically, he wrote All You Need Is Love, which is such an unbelievably beautiful song.
Hmm. Let's go back to the John Paul connection here. At one point in the book, you say that their bond was one of the central mysteries of the book that you have written. What's mysterious about it?
It's wild because John and Paul were two boyfriends who became very, very close when they were teenage boys, and they kind of grew up together, and they went through their 20s together. And it's funny that they formed a bond that was very troublesome for them because they were two completely different personalities, and yet it was a bond that followed them around their whole lives, and they couldn't get away from it, and it was kind of baffling to them. after the band broke up and after John and Paul went through years of being enemies, that, you know, people still around the world really felt the John and Paul friendship and heard themselves in that John and Paul friendship and really identified with it. And it was always amusing to them or infuriating to them. John had a great line in the 70s. He said, "If I took up ballet dancing, my ballet dancing would be compared with Paul's bowling." And it was just that even when they tried to build their separate lives as adults, they were still kind of stuck together because they'd made all this beautiful music together.
Mm, let's hear some more music.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here.
That's always been one of my favorites. What a sweet song.
What a beautiful song, yeah.
I know. It's beautiful. How, wait, place it. When was it?
It was 1966, and that's a song that he actually wrote by John's swimming pool. He went out to John's house in the afternoon. They used to have these afternoon writing sessions, and John was still asleep because John liked to sleep late. And so while Paul was waiting for John to wake up, he sat by the swimming pool with the guitar, and he wrote this song while he was waiting for John to wake up.
Really? Oh, it's just a beautiful, lovely song. Tom,
I love when he says, "changing my life with a wave of her hand."
Yes, yes. Sarah is next in Manitowoc. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, when I was when Hard Day's Night came out, I was around 13 years old, and you had talked about the electricity in the air whenever, even when they weren't really there. But we, it was a whole audience full of young girls, and all we did was scream through the whole movie. We couldn't even hear what was being said. It was years later when I finally saw it again that I actually saw the movie. So just wanted to share that.
Mm.
I love that.
Thank you.
I love the sort of visceral excitement that comes from seeing the Beatles. I can only imagine what it was like to see that movie on TV or you know, in the theater full of other Beatle fans. I first saw Help when I was 5 years old, and it was the first time I ever heard the Beatles or saw the Beatles. And that was on TV, and watching it with my grandmother. And it was really funny that the movie begins and the Beatles are playing and singing, and just instantly it was like being hit by the thunderbolt.
Mm. Ringo, we haven't spent much time on him. Two schools of thought, you write: a brilliant drummer who made the Beatles possible, or a clod who got lucky. Your view is that Ringo was a genius and the Beatles were blessed to snag him.
Yes, I think the Beatles, they could not have done it without Ringo, and all the Beatles agreed that Ringo was the essential musical element that put them over the top. Someone mentioned Pete Best before, who was the drummer that they had before.
Mm-hmm.
And he was someone, the Beatles liked him very much because he had a van and because he could drive them around to gigs. They never lied about that. They liked Pete Best because he had the van. But he wasn't a drummer who could keep up with them musically. Ringo was a great drummer who, as John said, was already a star in Liverpool before he even met the Beatles. He was with another band, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. And Ringo was just a fantastic drummer. And Paul said when they were playing with Ringo and he could keep up with the rhythm shifts of the songs and they could write all these songs, that they wouldn't have been able to play without him. And John and Paul agreed that was really when the Beatles began.
Hmm. Ringo looks fabulous. Of all the Beatles, well, George and John, of course, have died. But he looks really good, and he's not a real young guy. I saw him a few years ago, and I said, "Whoa, Ringo, you're looking good."
He's taken great care of himself.
I guess.
He got sober and got healthy, and he's It's amazing how, for somebody who wasn't expected to live beyond his teens, he's become this eternal wizard that we all love so much.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, thanks for your call. Let's go to Maurice in Madison. Hi, Maurice.
Hi. I just thought I'd mention about their perfectionism. Mm. Because I think the reason they went to Germany was to really hone their craft. But in the studio, they just really worked at really getting it right. They were very proud of their work, that in a sense that they didn't want to put out a crappy product.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my little observation.
Yeah, and you write about those sessions. Tell us about some of them. They did work and work and work.
They worked incredibly hard. You are absolutely right. Their perfectionism really drove them on. And it was funny how with Sgt. Pepper, they had quit touring. They were just going to concentrate full-time on going into the studio and making the best records that they could. And Sgt. Pepper, they just had so much energy and so many ideas, and they pour so much imagination into that one album. And you can hear it's the fun and excitement that they had, that they're finally getting to try all these ideas, and every song is just full of experiments.
Mm. Well,
I was just in London last week. I went to Abbey Road Studios to listen to the outtakes from Sgt. Pepper.
Oh, great.
Because they're releasing a 50th anniversary edition this summer to celebrate the anniversary of the record. And so they're putting all these outtakes on it that have been sitting in the vaults for 50 years. And it was really amazing to be in Abbey Road, you know, in Studio 2, the room where they made the album, listening to just hours of outtakes and all these different approaches that they had to the songs. You know, like when they started Fixing a Hole, it was a really rocking song. And when they tried With a Little Help from My Friends, it was more of a ballad. And all these different approaches that they had so many different ideas for every song, and it's just really kind of astounding.
Oh, that must have been a great way to spend some time listening to all of those. That's an understatement.
That was a pretty happy day, I have to say.
I bet it was. Our guest this hour is Rob Sheffield. He's the author of Dreaming the Beatles, The Love Story of One Band and the Whole World. Rob is a columnist for Rolling Stone, and he's the author of the national bestsellers Love is a Mixtape, Love and Lost, One Song at a Time, and Talking to Girls about Duran Duran, One Young Man's Quest for True Love, and A Cooler Haircut. Oh, yeah. And he's written other books as well. But we're talking the Beatles this hour and welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Should be our spring anthem. Did George write the lyrics to that song as well, Rob?
Yes, he did. There was a song that he wrote. He was sitting in Eric Clapton's garden, and it was a spring afternoon, and he was supposed to be going to a business meeting with the Beatles, but he decided he didn't want to go, so he played hooky, and he just sat in Eric Clapton's garden with the guitar, and the sun was out, and he just wrote that beautiful song in one afternoon.
Oh, aren't you glad he missed the meeting?
I'm so glad he skipped that meeting. Oh, my gosh. I've loved that song so intensely since I was a kid. That's one of those Beatles songs that I've heard literally thousands of times, and I'm never, ever, ever tired of it.
No, I'm not either, and I've heard it many, many times, too. It's a good one. Maurice, thank you so much for your call, and let us go to Margie in Milwaukee. Hello, Margie.
Hi. I love that story about George Harrison. I hadn't heard that. That's great to know.
Mm-hmm.
The Beatles and I go way back. I was born in 1953, and I was in love with them, you know, by 1964 or whenever they made their first trip over. And I still remember eating fried chicken in front of the Ed Sullivan Show. when they were on, and my mother wouldn't let me go see them when I was 11 or 12 because she was afraid I'd be trampled to death.
Oh.
And so launch forward to 93, and Paul McCartney's coming to the stadium and in Milwaukee, and my daughter was graduating from high school, and she loved the Beatles. I loved the Beatles, so I bought her a couple of tickets to the Beatles concert, and I took a friend with me, and I thought it would be really cool, but I did not expect the time warp. When I saw Paul McCartney's shadow off stage holding his left-handed guitar, I was 12 again. My knees buckled, and I was just, my heart was pounding, and by the time he was on stage saying, "I want to hold your hand," I was crying, and I was screaming, and my daughter's looking at me like, where did my mother go? And at one point, I jump on the chairs, and I'm going, "My mom wouldn't let me go see you when I was 12 years old today." And the whole section where we were sitting was applauding me. And it was the most embarrassing, but most exciting thing I had ever done. That was just it. I couldn't believe how it took me back.
Oh, Margie, I'm so glad you got a chance. Right? You got
Boy,
your chance.
Boy, me too. I
absolutely.
Love that story.
Yeah. Oh, that is a wonderful
absolutely.
Story. Wonderful story. And Paul, you still think his voice isn't certainly what it was, but you still say he's one of the best live performers. He gives the best show around. Rob.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I saw him last summer. He was touring. He'll be touring again in the fall. He just announced today. He was playing. I just went to see him at a hockey rink in Washington, D.C. And it was absolutely unbelievable. He plays for 3 hours and he does 40 songs or something like that. He ended the show doing side two of Abbey Road all the way through. And it was so amazing to be in an audience like that where there's old people and young people and people from all different cultures and generations. There's no boundaries at all. And everybody is singing along with every word. And it was just so unbelievably joyful. So I felt like Margie too. Like just it was so transporting and so, so joyous.
Oh, Margie, was that ever transporting for you? It's a great story. Steve in Madison, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to say it's so nice to hear Mr. Sheffield. I want to commend him for the great work that he and all the other Beatles journalists do. I'm a retired music educator and professional musician, and I have the great pleasure of playing in a really fun Beatles cover band, not a look-alike tribute band, but a pretty serious music group that really digs in and replicates the music. One name I haven't heard yet mentioned on the show today is that of George Martin, and I'll be interested to hear what Mr. Sheffield has to say about that.
Thanks, Steve.
They were so lucky to meet George Martin. When you think of all the coincidences that had to fall into place for the Beatles to happen, but that was one of the most important ones, is they had this producer who was just a technical wizard and a real musical mind, a classically trained guy. And he was older, and he was very straight and very gentlemanly. The Beatles used to call him Mr. Martin. And yet, he was someone who was totally sympathetic, and they would come in with these crazy ideas. And instead of explaining why it couldn't be done, George Martin would find a way to make it possible. And he was just an absolute wizard who made everything possible. And it's funny that when he first met the Beatles, he had no reason to think they were anything special. They were a bunch of kids. And he asked if there was anything they didn't like, and just to tell him. And George Harrison said, "Well, for one thing, I don't like your tie." And he just laughed. And you think, if thank goodness he laughed at that joke. If he'd been offended by it, just think of how history would have been different.
Right.
It all began in that laugh.
Mm. And let's go to Barbara in Wausau, probably our final caller. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I was a senior in high school when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964, and I watched it with my parents, and my father, who was a great music lover of jazz and big band and so forth, said, "Well, they're all right, but they'll never have the staying power of somebody like Frank Sinatra
right.
or Ella Fitzgerald."
Bing Crosby.
He was in his 40s at the time, but by the time he was in his 70s, he said, "You know, they really were great musicians."
That's wonderful. Oh, Rob, what fun that. This has been. We could talk for hours. Thank you so much for writing the book.
Thank you so much. Yeah. What a joy to talk Beatles with you.
Yeah,
thank you so
great.
Much.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Sheffield, our guest this hour, Dreaming the Beatles, the love story of one band and the whole world. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this wonderful hour, and thanks to Gretchen Brown for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for listening. News is next. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1:00.